Joining us on the line now from the UK is Nuala Calvi. She's one of the authors of the Sunday Times bestseller, The Sugar Girls. She joined us previously on the book show to talk about that book. It was all about female workers at Tate and Lyle's East End factories from the 1940s to the 1960s. But she's with us again on the book show to talk about her latest book, also written with her partner, Duncan Barrett. It's called G.I. Brides, all about the wartime girls who crossed the Atlantic for love. And it was inspired by her grandmother's story, Margaret, because Nuala promised her shortly before her death in 2012 that she would write her story. And you have, Nuala.
Yes, I have. I've done what I promised.
Oh, well done. Fantastic. So how was the experience of writing this, which I guess was a much more personal story for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it started off because I grew up knowing one man as my grandfather, but actually discovered over time that my real grandfather was an American GI that my grandmother had met during the war. And she never really talked about it until her second husband died and she began to open up a bit more. And I was astonished to hear that, you know, she'd had this whole other life before I'd known her. And so it was a very personal journey for me. I went to America and actually managed to track down some of these long-lost American relatives that I hadn't known I had, and even met an uncle out there that I didn't know existed. So for me, it was a really amazing personal journey as well.
And what did they all think of you writing the book?
Well, they were quite excited about me writing the book. And also it was strange because when I got there, I discovered that my grandfather and actually an aunt that I have out there both were writers too. So I kind of discovered that this was a gene in my family that I didn't know about. And also, I mean, I suppose to some extent, because the way that my grandfather treated my grandmother, I mean, the reason that she ended up back in Britain was that the marriage broke down and he had an alcohol problem. So I was a bit nervous that they wouldn't like someone coming along and researching that and writing about it. But I was kind of relieved to discover that, you know, they knew exactly what he was like and actually told me lots more stories about the antics that he got up to. So it turned out to be very useful.
Oh, wonderful. And let's talk a little bit about the history of the GI Brides. There was about 70,000 GI Brides crossed the Atlantic at the end of the war.
Yeah, that's right. There were 70,000 of them, and they began transporting them in earnest in 1946. And this was a massive operation which the US Army undertook. But for quite a while after the war first ended, they hadn't really taken this into account, the American Army, the fact that basing all their troops here would mean that inevitably there'd be all these romances with local women. And they suddenly realised they had a huge job on their hands and they weren't prepared for it. And in the meantime, the brides were getting very angry because, you know, their husbands were being shipped back to America and they were being left behind. And there were actually huge protests in London outside the American embassy by all these brides and often their children as well, who would hold up banners saying things like, "We want our dads and we demand ships." And even when Mrs. Roosevelt came to London, they campaigned outside her hotel. So it was becoming a bit of an embarrassment for the US government. And eventually this Act of Congress was passed called the War Brides Act, which allowed them to come in as non-quota immigrants at the Army's expense. And that was really when the whole war bride transport program began in earnest.
And these American men were very different to the British men that the British women were used to. They seemed to pay a lot more compliments. They actually earned a lot more money, so they showered the women with gifts. And it was all new and exciting, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think that these women had been pretty starved of male company during the war because all the young men had gone off to fight, and, you know, life in wartime Britain was pretty drab, you know, there weren't nice clothes around, there wasn't much money, and suddenly all these handsome, glamorous men arrived from America, you know, a country that people only knew through Hollywood movies. So for many women, it was almost as if Hollywood had come to town when the Americans showed up. And yes, they were paid five times that of the British Tommies, so they could flash the cash on dates. You know, they also had access to things that we hadn't seen in Britain for a long time because all their food was shipped over from America, and they had their own shops, the Army PX shops, so they could buy things for women like perfume. nylon stockings, lipstick, chocolates, you know, little luxuries really that suddenly made life in wartime Britain a whole lot rosier.
Mm. And with the lack of money, when they actually did get married in the UK, that it was quite difficult for many reasons. Wedding dresses, for example, were very hard to come by, and a lot of the women would make their own out of parachutes, which I didn't realise.
Yeah. That's right, because the parachutes are made out of silk, really beautiful silk. So, you know, it was perfect for wedding dresses, and it was virtually impossible to get enough material, high-quality material on ration to make a wedding dress. Lots of women got married in borrowed or rented dresses. One woman we spoke to had a dress and a veil from the dead wife of a neighbour, you know. So often people were getting married and, you know, not looking how they would ideally like to look. And yes, if a plane came down and there was a parachute out there, there would be a scramble to see who could get their hands on it first and, you know, wash it, cut it up and make it into a wedding dress.
Wow. And before the brides left, there was quite a strategic mission, if you like, an inspection as well, which really wasn't very nice for a lot of these women.
Yeah, that's right. The girls had to be interviewed by the American's commanding officer. And sometimes they would ask things like, you know, are you just getting married as a ticket to America? Because, you know, America was the richer country and, you know, a lot of brides were portrayed in the press as well as kind of money grabbing and getting married just as a way of getting a better life. And there was a lot of red tape around getting married. The army often tried to discourage its men from marrying while they were overseas. But even if they got past those hurdles, and before they could get on a ship, they had to go to an army camp called Tidworth on Salisbury Plain, where, again, they were put through a lot of questioning and also some quite humiliating medical examinations. And they could be kept there for days and days before they were actually allowed to leave and take a ship to America. And some of the women found it so grueling that they actually walked out and said, well, you know, if our husbands really want us, they can come and get us. Because it was such an unpleasant experience, unfortunately.
And then the women who did get to America, the American women weren't particularly pleased to see them.
That's right. One of the book concentrates on four main women's stories, and one of them, Lynn, she arrived in America to see American women holding placards saying, British whores, go home. You're stealing our men. And much as, you know, British men had the idea that American men had come over and stolen their women, once the women got to America, the shoe was on the other foot, and a lot of American women weren't too pleased to discover that, you know, the local boys had married British women and were bringing them over and kind of reducing the pool of available men.
Mm. And something which, I don't know, something which seems very old-fashioned to me. I can't imagine it happening now at all. But the USA were given lectures, if you like, to these British women on how they should behave and conduct themselves in America, and also how to pledge allegiance to the flag, which, of course, is very important.
That's right. Well, on the ships, the American Red Cross were in charge of looking after the women. And, I mean, they were great. They would organise lots of activities like sing-alongs, bingo, knitting clubs, exercise clubs, things like this. But one of the things they did do was to organise these lectures on things like how to behave as an American bride and, you know, learning the national anthem and learning to salute the flag and things like that. So, and they also did police the women quite rigidly. They would go on these patrols at night, which were dubbed morality patrols, to check that none of the women were running off with sailors on the ship, which was reportedly something that had been happening. So, you know, there was an extent to which they were quite moralistic towards the women as well.
Yeah. One of the ladies you mentioned, Lynn, is that Gwendolyn?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. She had a terrible time with her mother-in-law, didn't she?
She did. She married this lovely guy, an Italian-American guy, and it was very romantic, but she hadn't expected to have such a hard time from his mother, who he was extremely close to. And when they first got there, like many brides, they found that it was hard for the men to get jobs because so many servicemen were returning. So many of these couples had to live with the man's parents, and you can imagine, you know, what that was like, having to live with your in-laws. And Lynn and her mother-in-law got on each other's nerves more and more, and eventually she turned around and said to Ben, Lynn's husband, "It's her or me," and forced him to choose between his mother and his wife. And luckily for Lynn, he chose his wife. But because he didn't have a job and they had nowhere else to go, they ended up actually living in a kind of shack in the woods for a while until he managed to get a job and they were managed to get a flat and be independent. But funnily enough, over time, Lynn actually found that she and her mother-in-law became the best of friends, and that when hard times struck, it was the mother that was really there for her and ended up being a kind of replacement mum for her own mum that she left behind.
Oh, that's nice. Oh, I'm glad it had a happy ending, because a lot of the stories do seem quite sad, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think overall, the level of divorce among these GI marriages was actually slightly lower than in the general population. But, you know, all the women struggled to some extent when they first got there with things like just adjusting to a completely new culture, being accepted by a new family, having to cope without the friends and family that they'd left behind. And, you know, I think you find that a lot of them struggled with homesickness and things like that. And, of course, there were those who turned up to find that, you know, the guy who they thought owned a huge ranch was in fact, you know, a pig farmer in the middle of nowhere, or this mansion on the beach that they said they had turned out to be, you know, a little shack somewhere. So I think there was a lot of bragging that went on when the GIs came over, and a lot of women discovered that life in America wasn't what they were expecting and wasn't like a Hollywood movie.
No. And Ray had a similar experience, one of your GI brides, who said that she didn't particularly like Americans, but she met this guy called Raymond who really wore down her resistance, and she agreed to marry him. Then after the war, she reluctantly followed him to rural Pennsylvania, where she soon discovered he was a well-known womanizer in his hometown. How awful!
Yeah, I know. Poor Ray. Well, I mean, I suppose when they're in Britain, you know, the GIs could be whoever they decided they were going to be. And you it's hard to really know a person when they're out of the context of their real life and their hometown and the people that really know them. And, you know, as with my grandmother, with my real grandfather, who turned out to be a less than heroic once he was out of uniform, you know, Ray also discovered that her husband wasn't the great guy she had imagined, and actually even when she was on the ship over, he was already cheating on her. And so she made the very brave decision, like my grandmother, to leave him. But he threatened to deport her from America, and out of stubbornness and refusal to let him get his way, she remained in the States and became an American citizen in her own right, and ended up falling in love with another American man, and, you know, living happily ever after in America.
Good for her.
She kind of won in the end, yeah.
So are you pleased with the book now it's complete? Do you think Margaret would have approved?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, my grandmother obviously died before I started writing the book, so I can only guess what she would have felt. But I got the strong sense from her when she was nearing the end of her life that she really wanted her story to be told. And, you know, although it's quite a sad story in some ways, she would say to me, you know, "I'm an old lady now. I don't care what anyone thinks anymore." That was her attitude. So I've tried to kind of go with that and tell it as truthfully as I can, really.